From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, spending 5 months aboard the dark, cluttered, smelly, and deteriorating Russian space station Mir. We talk with retired U.S. astronaut Jerry Lininger, who participated in a joint U.S.-Russian mission on Mir in 1997. In his new book, Off the Planet, he describes how he and the Russian cosmonauts struggled to keep themselves and Mir alive as they faced failing systems, fires, and even an unmanned cargo ship hurtling towards them at 18,000 miles per hour. Surviving 5 months in space, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senator John McCain was in Michigan today campaigning for the state's 58 delegates to the Republican National Convention. McCain crisscrossed Michigan before heading home to Arizona, which also holds a Republican primary tomorrow. More from Matthew Ferguson of Michigan Public Radio.
Polls show Senator McCain in a virtual dead heat with his rival Texas Governor George W. Bush. Today, McCain spoke before a crowd of over 1,000 students at a high school in the eastern Michigan city of Saginaw. There, he called for more school choice, higher pay for teachers, and campaign finance reform. He also asked the students for their support, even though most are not old enough to vote.
I want you to go home and make sure your parents vote. I don't care if your parents or if you are 18, I want you to vote. Or if you're 16, try and sneak in. That's a joke. That's a joke.
The Michigan primary is open to any registered voter in the state, and analysts predict participation of Democrats and independents will be the deciding factor. For NPR News, I'm Matthew Ferguson in Saginaw, Michigan.
Texas Governor George W. Bush is also campaigning in Michigan. He won the South Carolina poll by 11 points and has the support of Michigan Governor John Engler and most of the state's Republican officials. He warned supporters today that Democrats may cross over to vote for McCain and called on Republicans to produce a big turnout for him. Polls in Michigan show the two candidates to be almost even. NATO troops used tear gas to control a crowd of ethnic Albanians in the troubled town of Mitrovica in Kosovo today. The Albanians are demanding that NATO reunify the town, which has been divided between Serbs and Albanians since the end of the NATO bombing campaign. NPR's Silvia Poggioli is in Mitrovica.
Today there was a huge march. People came from all over Kosovo. They marched on Mitrovica. And it's extraordinary because it's incredibly cold. They walked from Pristina, many thousands, about 30 miles. And at one point there was a big sort of assault on the lines of the NATO troops about 200, 300 yards from the main bridge. They broke through the ranks. They reached the edge of the bridge. French troops launched a lot of tear gas, very intense tear gas in the city today.
NPR's Silvia Poggioli in Mitrovica, Kosovo. More than 30,000 people marched today in San Juan, Puerto Rico, protesting the Navy's plan to resume using a bombing range on Vieques Island. Puerto Rican national leaders organized the march to repudiate an agreement between Governor Pedro Rosselló and President Clinton that would have allowed limited training at the range. The agreement would have permitted the Navy to use non-exploding bombs. A referendum is to be held sometime next year to allow Puerto Ricans to choose whether to allow the Navy to resume training. This is NPR News from Washington. Preliminary results from Iran's parliamentary elections continue to show that reformers are in the lead. Final results from Friday's voting are not expected for several days, but so far reform candidates appear to have won in most urban centers and to have gained control of parliament. Iran's Arab neighbors welcomed the results, saying it could open up fresh dialogues on regional disputes, such as the fate of three islands in the Persian Gulf that are claimed by both Iran and the United Arab Emirates. Turkey's prime minister said the new government could revitalize relations with his country. The astronauts aboard Space Shuttle Endeavour are wrapping up their mission in Earth orbit. The crew retracted and stowed the 200-foot-long antenna that helped map the Earth with radar. The mapping did not go smoothly. More from Pat Duggins of member station WMFE in Orlando.
Endeavor carries 14 tons of radar equipment in its cargo bay, and all of it has to be secured before the bumpy trip down from orbit. The astronauts retracted the 200-foot-long radar antenna, but it didn't latch tightly for landing. NASA thought the problem might be the cables on the antenna were stiff from the cold temperatures of Earth orbit. The astronauts turned the shuttle so sunlight could stream into the payload bay. On the third try, the three latches worked. The only concern now for Tuesday's planned touchdown is an iffy weather forecast for Florida. There's the threat of low clouds and crosswinds that could violate NASA safety rules. Just in case, NASA also named Edwards Air Force Base in California as a backup landing site. If Endeavor comes down in Florida, it'll be the 50th shuttle landing at Kennedy Space Center. Touchdown is set for just before 5 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
The U.S. stock markets were closed today for the holiday weekend. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jerry Lininger, is a former astronaut who spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir in 1997. He traveled the equivalent distance of 110 round trips to the moon and back. He says working on board the Mir wasn't easy. The space station was in a state of deterioration, communication with Russian ground control was terrible, and something was always going wrong. After surviving a couple of near catastrophes, Lininger took a spacewalk at 18,000 miles an hour, some 250 miles above Earth. Lininger's presence on Mir was part of a cooperative mission between the U.S. and Russians to lay the groundwork for an international space station. He was the only American on board and had to get by with his minimal skills speaking Russian. He's written a new book about his experiences aboard the Russian space station called Off the Planet. Lininger was taken to the space station by the U.S. space shuttle Atlantis. I asked him to describe what it looked like inside Mir.
You know, when we first flew into Mir, I got admitted, compared to the shuttle, it had sort of the feel of going into your grandmother's cellar down the basement. Sort of a moldy smell to it, a little bit darkened. Electrical power on Mir is always at a premium, and therefore not many lights are on. So it was very cramped and, I guess, claustrophobic feeling. I'm pretty good about not getting claustrophobic myself, so I can't say that it hit me that way. But it definitely hit me as a very confining, dark, damp sort of atmosphere when you fly into Mir.
And it also looks like, from the photos, like there's wires all over the place.
There's a lot of dangling. It's about, at this stage, about 14-year-old space station. And just like a home that maybe wasn't wired correctly at the beginning, as you add on and put on new modules and new equipment, you need to run extension cords and wire cables and air ducts to blow the to keep the circulation going. So it's a bag of spaghetti up there, lots of wires, and lots of possible mistakes is what that creates also. The cluttered effect up there can get you into trouble.
What did space smell like, look like, taste like, sound like?
Space, I'll tell you, when you fly into Mir, it smelled like sort of like dirty sweat socks in a guy's locker room. Actual smell of space, so that's a very interesting question. When we would open a hatch, for example, that was exposed to the vacuum of space, there's always a double hatch. And so you open the one hatch, you now have the pure smell of space. And it's a tough, you know, as any aroma is tough to describe, but it has a distinct smell, and it's sort of a burned out after the fire the next morning in your fireplace sort of smell. And that's the real smell of the vacuum of space. And it was very distinctive. After we'd get through that hatch and open the next hatch, for example, if it was a resupply ship that just came up, you'd get the smell of fresh lemons, and that would just go through the air, and it was just an incredible contrast to that sock smell, dirty sock smell, or the burned-out smell of the vacuum of space. And then you get this smell of the Earth.
Does space have a sound?
When you're out there, for example, during a spacewalk, it is utter silence. It's a vacuum. Sound doesn't conduct. The sound of inside Space Station Mir was one of a factory almost, with lots of turning equipment, noise level very high. And when we lost electrical power and moved to the dark side of the Earth, and everything ground to a halt, and we started spinning through space, tumbling sort of out of control. The silence was just deafening, and a scary silence, I might add. I mean, so silent that it's just scary.
How long did that go on for?
We had some power problems, and that went on. Took us about 2 days to recover from that, and every time you'd move to the dark side of the Earth, it was darkness like you've never seen and silence that was scary. We worked with flashlights, eventually regained power.
What was the typical day like, if there is such thing as a typical day, on board the spaceship Mir?
There wasn't many typical days. At the beginning, though, the way it worked, the alarm would go off in the morning, and you'd have to check your watch immediately to make sure it was not a master alarm and rather just a morning wake-up call. That was usually around 8 o'clock, so sort of leisurely, if you will, but you never got to bed before usually 1 in the morning. You know, you'd get up and do your daily tasks of living, a little bit different and unique in space, of course, and go down and suck down a tube of dehydrated borscht or, you know, mashed potatoes or some strange breakfast foods. And then you'd get to work. You'd check a schedule, and you were working from day to night, essentially trying to do experiments and also trying to keep up with the repairs that needed to be done to keep the space station alive. You'd go to bed at night exhausted. I'd strap myself to the wall. I used to sleep upside down on the wall, piece of Velcro around me. Close my eyes, and I'd sleep like a baby.
What were some of the experiments you had to carry out?
Had about 120 different experiments. Looked at a lot of microbial sampling around Mir to see of any contamination, to see if I, for example, introduced any new bacteria to the space station with my arrival. A lot of protein crystal growth experiments, metallurgy, melting samples, trying to get very pure alloys, because up there, of course, you don't have the problem of settling of the heavier elements down to the bottom, and you get a very pure alloy. You know, grew wheat up there, trying to look to the future of when you do space travel long distances and long periods of time. Just fascinating experiments, really, that really kept you hopping.
Let's get back to how you slept. You slept upside down, attached to...
Slept upside down, inverted, you know, a piece of Velcro around me. And the reason I did that is because it was a good fan on the floor. In space, warm air doesn't rise. There's no convection current. And so you have to have a fan to move the atmosphere around, or you will breathe yourself into an oxygen-depleted and carbon dioxide-rich bubble, and you'll wake up with a severe headache, hyperventilating, gasping for air. So I would sleep inverted, a piece of Velcro around me, just sort of dangle on the wall with a fan blowing in my face.
Did you sleep well in a gravity-free environment?
I slept pretty well. There was actually some sleep experiments I was doing. I had an eye sensor on, for example, look at my rapid eye movement sleep. I had electrodes on my head most nights. And if you looked at my sleep patterns, as the mission progressed, I was having less and less deep sleep and much more rapid eye movement sleep. And I would say on the last month of that five-month mission, I would wake up feeling very tired, and my sleep quality was going downhill.
Do you think it was stress and anxiety or something related to the atmosphere?
No, I think it has to do actually with your biorhythms, losing their sense of day and night. And in space, you're around the planet every 90 minutes, and every 45 minutes, you're getting a sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset. And so you're going through about 15 of those a day. Your body has a very hard time setting the biorhythm, and you start drifting from your Earth-linked biorhythms of a 24-hour day. You know, even the concept of time, when you think about it, it's an amazing world up there. We live in 24 hours in a day down here. You get up in space and you realize that that is an artificial thing that we've created because we're Earthlings. You get in space with in orbit every 90 minutes and you realize 24 hours is meaningless with day-night cycles every, you know, 45 minutes.
Now, one of the things that happened to you in space was that you grew 2 inches because of the weightlessness. What happens to the spine in space?
You know, the first day you get up there and you're an inch taller, and the next day I'm another inch taller, and I'm jumping, you know, with the best of them. I'm thinking, man, I can play in the NBA when I get back. unfortunately, it doesn't work. After about 2 days, your spine is stretched out. The muscles, the paraspinal muscles have relaxed. Your spine stretches out. And you remain at that height. As soon as you land and gravity starts yanking you back, you end up back at your normal height again. A lot of astronauts have a lot of problem with that, with a lot of back pain. And you'll see astronauts curled up sort of in the fetal position with Velcro straps around their legs to try to prevent that back pain. And sometimes they're forced to take different medications so that they can't sleep at night.
This is back pain upon re-arriving into the Earth's atmosphere?
Actually, no. When you're in space, just from that stretching of the spine, becomes uncomfortable, and the muscles around the vertebrae are not happy being stretched. And there's a lot of lower back pain and actually back pain throughout the back that causes a lot of sleepless nights for astronauts trying to adapt to space. I'm very fortunate. I'm probably 1 in 10, I would say, of Earthlings that can go to space and feel perfect from the get-go. No back pain, no nausea, no vomiting, no headaches, not very much fluid movement to my head even, so I didn't have a stuffy feeling like a lot of astronauts experience.
My guest is retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. He's written a new book about being in space. He spent 5 months aboard the space station Mir. His book is called Off the Planet. One of the things that I found really interesting is that you were expected to recycle urine for water.
It's a closed ecosystem, and you need to recycle everything you can. We would take our urine, collect it using basically a fan device, some valves, close the valve down. We take the urine, convert it to water. We'd be called by Mission Control Moscow to say, drink that water, it's good stuff. And we'd say, yeah, you drink it, we don't want to drink it, that's our urine. And instead we would take the water, H2O, split the hydrogen off. What's left over is oxygen. We'd vent the hydrogen to space. That's an explosive gas, don't want that around. And we'd breathe the oxygen. So essentially it's your urine to water, water to oxygen, and essentially you breathe your urine up on Space Station Mir.
It does sound better than drinking it.
You know, I've drunk a lot of bad things, and I've gone through Navy jungle survival school and eaten snakes and roots and everything else. And, you know, I finally convinced myself, you know, I can drink my urine to be an astronaut, but I could not drink anyone else's urine. And the cosmonauts felt much the same way, and we decided we would use that urine water to make oxygen. We would, though, use some sweat water, if you will. When you run on the treadmill, you perspire, and that would get into the atmosphere. We'd condense that water, purify it, and use some of that water for rehydrating our foods.
I'm glad you mentioned the treadmill. How did you exercise in space and give your muscles a workout? Because part of what works out the muscles is the tension against gravity.
Space is a tough environment, and it's funny to say tough because it is so effortless that it is hard to imagine. And I thought, that I sort of knew what it would be like in weightlessness, but I surprised myself, and it's tough to describe. I can tell you when I came back, first night in bed, in order to roll over, I had to grab my head, grab my shoulders, and yank myself against the pull of gravity that was pushing me down in that bed. And so when you go to space and you're going to be there for 5 months, it's worse than me saying, Terry, you need to go to bed right now and get up in 5 months. Because in bed, at least, you're resisting gravity. In space, it is effortless. Your body reacts to that by saying, I'm overbuilt. your bone says, I am a structure that is far too strong. I don't need all this bone mass, and it starts dumping calcium. And unfortunately, it doesn't turn that off. And when I came back 5 months later, I had about a 13% bone loss in my hips and lower spine because of disuse. In order to counter that, we try to exercise, and I would exercise religiously 2 1-hour periods a day, get onto a treadmill, put on what looked like a windsurfer harness, yank myself down into 70-kilogram load plates, and try to run and work out using bungee cords to try to counteract the effects of effortlessness. Unfortunately, that doesn't work because you've still got 22 hours in the day where you're just floating.
Did you get your bone mass back after staying
It took
on
me
Earth?
About, after 1 year, I regained about half of that 13% loss. So I was down to around 6% by doing MRI scans and different scans. At the 2 year point, I was back to about a 2% bone loss. Whether everyone gets it back is still something we need to look into, and hasn't been looked at that long. You go a long duration trip to Mars, for example, with a 2 year timetable, there's going to be significant bone loss, and that could be a showstopper.
You're really a human experiment, having spent 5 months in space.
You sort of are. And, you know, it was fascinating for me with my medical background just to sort of observe myself and try to be as objective as I could in observing myself. And it's not just physical. I'll tell you, the psychological battle is the toughest one, being cut off, isolated, totally off the planet, away from your friends, away from 24-hour time. It is isolation that is just profound and unlike anything I ever experienced.
You studied the psychology of isolation, and you worked in isolated environments for a long time. You were in the Navy for about 20 years, so you've worked on ships, you've worked on deserted islands, so you knew something about isolation. Describe how isolation in space is different from what you ever faced in the Navy.
You know, I try to prepare myself, and I'll tell you, past life experiences are what helps you out to get through new experiences like being out in space and being a spaceman. But nothing I had done, you know, living on islands or going out to sea on a submarine or any of those past life experiences really prepared me for that profound isolation. And I'll tell you, it was a 5-month test for me, you know, seeing if I had the right stuff, if I could hold up, stay efficient, work hard.
Did you go through any bad depressions?
I did not. I did observe some people that had serious, what I'd call clinical depression up there. It is a psychological battle. My game plan, I watched someone that we overlapped with, one of the cosmonauts, who looked like he had held up well, and he was at the end of his 5th month of stay on Mir, and I tried to mimic him for the first few months. And the main thing I learned is to try to stick to a schedule, try to stay, for example, on Earth time, go to bed at midnight in Moscow, even though it was meaningless up there, exercise religiously, try to keep some routine in your life. When I'd run on the treadmill, I'd have my CD playing, and I'd close my eyes and visualize myself back on Earth, sort of, you know, running through my old favorite routes to sort of escape. And during those moments, some great things happened, too. I could feel the presence of my dad there with me. He's deceased. He's there with Uncle Bill. They told me they're proud of what I'm doing. So anyway, you do what you can to sort of escape, meditate, if you will, and get away from that shock of isolation.
What CDs did you bring to space with you?
Oh, I had Bob Seger playing real loud. He kept me going. I'm an old Detroit boy, so I had some old music there, Bruce Springsteen, and, you know, anything to kind of liven things up. You had to always be careful when you shut your CD off. You didn't want to open it too soon, or you'd have a flying saucer going through the space station as the, you know, CD went flying across like a saucer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. He spent 5 months in space on the Russian space station Mir. Now he's written a new book about the 5 months in space called Off the Planet. You were with two other astronauts, Russian astronauts, while you were in space, and you had to speak Russian the whole time. This was part of a Russian-American cooperation program. When you're alone with two other people for 5 months and you're hundreds of miles away from Earth, do you run out of things to talk about?
Do you run out of things to talk about? I'll tell you, with Russian language, fairly new to me, I had about a year and a half crash course while I was training over in Star City, Russia. It's hard to have much small talk in a language that's not your native tongue. The three of us really depended on each other. We were definitely a team up there. I knew I could depend on them, trust them. But you do run out of things to say after a while. The cultural barrier and, them being Russian and me being American, you can't ask, how the Red Wings did last week or, you actually just start running out of things to talk about up there.
You know, it surprised me. You say the space station Mir had a good bar and that although you didn't partake, that the two Russian cosmonauts, did a fair amount of drinking. It's against NASA rules to drink while on the job, but you say you also didn't want to diminish your senses in any way when anything could happen. But I was surprised to hear that they did drink.
They have a smuggling operation that's sort of, everyone knows it's happening when they sort of ignore it. But they, for example, when I unloaded my spacesuit, I was going to do a spacewalk in a brand new Russian spacesuit. When I unloaded it from a resupply ship, there was a bottle of vodka stuffed in the sleeve. So I would say this, though, is the only place, or my entire time in Russia there and in space, it was the only time that no one cared whether I drank or not. Over in Russia, there's toast for this, toast for that, and if you don't want to partake, it's still sort of the way it was back in the 60s here where, people hitting you on the back saying, hey, come on, you got a drink, we're all drinking. But up in space with a limited supply, I think my crewmates were glad that I did not partake. But they never got rip-roaring drunk or anything like that. It was more of a after dinner, try to relax, and before they went to bed. But I didn't like the idea of not being 100% because it was a very dangerous environment up there.
I would imagine being hungover in space would not be pleasant.
I don't think it would be good at all. There's enough space motion sickness going around up there that, you need to adapt to that. That's something you probably don't need. There's a lot of flying up there, too, and drinking and flying don't mix very well. So it's probably not, in my mind, a good idea.
Retired astronaut Jerry Lininger, he's written a new book called Off the Planet, Surviving 5 Perilous Months Aboard the Space Station Mir. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Fools and sorrow.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what it's like to take a spacewalk at 18,000 miles an hour, some 250 miles above Earth. We continue our conversation with former U.S. astronaut Jerry Lininger.
I'm trying to get the funky job done. Put myself.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. His new book, Off the Planet, is about the 5 months he spent aboard the Russian space station Mir in 1997 as part of a cooperative mission between the U.S. and Russia. Lininger says that when he traveled on the U.S. space shuttle, he never heard the master alarm go off, but on Mir, alarms went off two or three times a day, warning of oxygen failures, computer failures, and other major problems. One time the alarm was set off by a fire that nearly destroyed Mir and the men aboard it. Let's talk about the big fire that nearly destroyed you, your fellow astronauts, and the space station. What caused the fire?
The fire actually originated as a large canister made out of metal, sort of looks like a garbage can, if you will, and it's filled with a slurry of oxygen-rich chemical. I'm in my module typing on a laptop computer up on the ceiling. I hear the blang, blang, blang master alarm going off again. I hit the enter button. I sort of look around and I'm almost could do diagnoses up there. And I look around and I notice the walls aren't moving, so I know we haven't lost what's called attitude control. We're not tumbling. I notice my computer's still working. We haven't lost power. I hit the enter button. I push off to go turn the corner to go look at the master alarm panel. Before I can get there, Vasily Sablayev comes flying fast around the corner, and I yell out, Seriosny, and he says, Da, ochen pajar. I asked, is it serious? He said, yes, very, fire. He really didn't have to respond because behind him I just saw a big trail of smoke coming, just billowing out of the module. Continue forward, get to the caution and warning panel, look down, looks like a Christmas tree lit up. We've got fire warning lights flashing, smoke warning lights, low voltage lights. I look down the length of the module, sort of like looking down to the back end of a school bus, if you will, and out of that solid fuel oxygen canister is coming a big flame. It's about 3 feet long. Sparks flying out the end of it, smoke billowing out. Within about 30 seconds, I can't see the fingers in front of my face. The smoke was just everywhere, fast. I look down at the hull. It's made out of aluminum. Aluminum's about an eighth of an inch thick, and that's our protection against the vacuum of space. I look down, realize if this blowtorch of a fire points down, it's going to puncture the hull, rapid decompression, quick suffocation. I actually said out loud, I said, not good, were my first words, you know, understatement of my life. Turned back, went to get an oxygen mask, smoke everywhere, can't see the fingers in front of my face. Start feeling my way along the bulkhead, feeling like I'm about 25 meters underwater, no air, feeling lightheaded. Finally locate my personal respirator, grab the rubber mask out, yank it over my head. I activate the oxygen canister by throwing a lever. I breathe in, and I get nothing. Check the position of the lever again. It's set correctly. I breathe in again. Mask collapses around my face. I've got a failed respirator. Throw the mask off. I look around as I'm feeling my way along the wall trying to find a second respirator, and I yell out, actually, I say, Catherine, I love you, to my wife, and I say, I'm really sorry. Looks like I'm not going to make it back.
But you did. You found another respirator.
I did get to a second respirator.
And the fire burned itself out in, what, around 14 minutes?
Well, we went through one fire extinguisher. We went through a second fire extinguisher. I went through a third fire extinguisher. I was heading back for the fourth one. When Vasily yells, fires out, and about 14 minutes of burning, I'll tell you, in a closed space station, 14 minutes is a long time with a flame flying.
What are some of the unique qualities of fire in outer space?
Fire, for one thing, it's not flame-shaped. Warm air doesn't rise, so when a flame burns, the warm air does not rise and fresh air does not come in underneath it. Instead, it burns in its pure state as a sphere. And it will burn up the layer of oxygen around it and put itself out if you're not replenishing that oxygen by blowing a fan on it Or if the, you know, the other way it can happen, though, the source itself can have oxygen, as in the case of the fire on board that was out of control. That was a oxygen-rich chemical, and it had all the oxygen it needed. But other objects, you know, if you light a piece of paper up there, it will eventually burn the oxygen in the boundary layer around it, and it will put itself out without any effort on your part.
So how much damage was done to the space station by the fire?
The fire melted some of the valves and that behind it. The heat was intense, but as far as anything debilitating and long-term, once we cleaned it up and turned filters back on and swabbed everything down, you know, you don't want the particulates floating because you're going to be breathing them for the next 4 months. Really, the long-term effect of that was negligible.
You couldn't very well get out the smoke by opening up the window.
You goes through your head, I'll tell you, with that flame roaring. I went by a window, and first instinct tells you open a window. Second, you think call 911, get the heck out of here. You know, it gets through your head also. Unfortunately, the rescue vehicle is on the wrong side of the fire, and it's melting metal, and so there's no option to go that direction. But, yeah, all those things that, you know, just by instinct, getting low, for example. Immediately I go low to get a gasp of fresh air. Unfortunately, in space, warm air doesn't rise, smoke doesn't rise, smoke is everywhere. So all your earth instincts do not serve you well up there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Lininger. He's a retired astronaut who's written a new book called Off the Planet about spending 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. He was there with two Russian cosmonauts. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is astronaut Jerry Lininger. He spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir, and he's written a new book called Off the Planet. Now, you disposed of your trash by doing what?
Well, we would get a resupply ship up there. It looks like a old capsule, like our old Mercury capsule would look like. It's filled with the supplies we need, food, some extra water, spacesuits, whatever we needed, repair parts. After we unloaded it, we would then use it as sort of a garbage truck, and we would take all of our discards and stuff it into that capsule, and it would detach from the space station. The ground would control it, Mission Control Moscow. They'd fire some thrusters. It would re-enter the atmosphere, burn up, and essentially disintegrate all the garbage.
Now, once after you sent away the Progress filled with your decomposing garbage and broken equipment, Russian ground control told you that it was going to redock with the space station. Why?
The Russians were interested in testing whether we could do a manual docking of this unmanned resupply ship. And that sounds like you can't do that because it's unmanned, but it was a remote control setup where there was a camera inside the capsule and a monitor inside the space station. And so my crewmate, Vasily Sublayev, would stand there with control sticks, look at the monitor, and would manually fly the spacecraft in as if he were sitting in the spacecraft by looking at the view in the monitor. Unfortunately, the monitor failed, and so you have a spacecraft coming at you at about 18,000 miles an hour that, regardless of how hard we looked, we could not locate. Vasily firing away at the thrusters, trying to break this thing when we finally realized it was coming at us at an uncontrollable speed. Very, very tense moment, sweat pouring from his brow. We'd run back to the window, you know, trying to describe which direction that capsule was going when he would put an impulse in was very difficult because there's nothing else out there, no other objects that you can say, you know, it's going right, left, up, down, because all that is Earth description and it doesn't work in space. So the Progress went zooming by us, missed us by what from our vantage up there looked like a matter of, 10 or 15 meters. And we held our breath as it whizzed by, hoping it wouldn't crash into any of the solar panels or into the hull of the Mir. Very tense moment.
What'd you say to Russian ground control when you survived?
Well, Vasily, the commander, was beside himself. He let the ground know exactly how we felt about an untested procedure, trying to dock this 18,000-mile-an-hour spacecraft sort of in the blind. And that was probably one of the low points of my time up there, actually, the broken trust between what the ground was doing in Moscow and what we cosmonauts and astronauts were trying to do up there in space.
It sounds like on the whole, relations between the astronauts and ground control was not very good.
The relationship was very strained, and it was a matter of, you really have to trust the people on the ground. Again, I got to emphasize, the ground in this case was Mission Control Moscow, not Mission Control Houston. And you got the impression that they wanted to keep that space station alive at all costs. And you also had the impression that we as the crew up there better just do exactly what they say, hang in there with that space station again at all costs. And maybe the space station was more important than we were.
Now, you took a 5-hour spacewalk when you were aboard the space station Mir. Can you describe what the procedure is? Like, what were you walking on or through?
First of all, walking in space, what an incredible thing. You're essentially a spacecraft. You're out there by yourself, dangling, in my case, on the end of an arm. 18,000 miles an hour, Earth below, the heavens around you, the stars. You see probably four times the number of stars you'd see from the best vantage point on Earth. It's just a, Yahoo feeling of, wow, incredible. And something that, I can look at it, frame by frame in my mind. You almost don't forget the split second by split second. It's such an incredible, incredible experience. The actual mechanics of it, you climb into the back door of a spacesuit, latch it. As scuba divers know, you're worried about the bends. It's a very similar thing. The spacesuit's going to be at half normal pressure. And so the first thing you do is breathe 100% oxygen to get the nitrogen out of your blood so that you don't get bent when you go out there, which means nitrogen bubbles forming in your arteries and causing physiological problems. Next thing I did is get my two tethers ready. I've got carabiners, if you will, hooks on the end of about a 4-foot rope. I open the hatch up, push it open, and then start being a mountain climber. Start hooking my hooks on exterior parts of the space station, working my way along the surface, dragging a 500-pound experiment behind me as if it weighed nothing.
Now, when you first got outside the spaceship, what did you experience physically?
Physically, it's just the sight is overwhelming just to be out there dangling as an independent spacecraft, and it's just total uplifting experience. As the spacewalk progressed, I had to climb on the end of an arm. When that arm got swung through open space, I felt the feeling of detachment. Felt that I was out there all alone. Spacecraft, as I look back, space station Mir is looking like a tinker toy. And I had a feeling of total detachment, and it also hit me gut level. I felt the speed. I felt 18,000 miles an hour, and I felt as if I was falling off a cliff, just screaming with speed. And I did what I think 99% of the people of the world would do. I just grabbed on for dear life. White-knuckled terror, fear, overwhelming, and mumbled to myself, not good again, which was one of my expressions I used a lot on Mir. And then I told myself, hey, I got 5 hours of work to do. I've been training on the bottom of swimming pools for the last 6 months before the flight, and I'm going to get this job done somehow. I tricked myself. What I did, I looked down at the earth. I looked back up again. I said, Adin, Dva, Tri, Chetiri, Pyat, counted to five in Russian, looked back down at the earth. And I said, Jerry, it's okay to be falling at 18,000 miles an hour as long as you don't hit the bottom. And rationally, I knew I was in orbit. I was going 18,000 miles an hour, but we were going to keep orbiting. I wasn't going to hit the earth. I took the fear, tucked it away in a compartment of my brain that I was glad I had. Let go of my grip, and got swung out and continue with my job.
Did it feel good after this exhilarating but frightening 5-hour mission to get back into the mirror?
It, with some regrets, it felt good to get back in. I'll tell you, though, on the end of the arm, on the way back, I swung out. I had that feeling of overwhelming fear, overcame it, went and did the job. I got swung back in the other direction, same point in space, same sensation. This time, I just yelled out, Yahoo. I attached myself with my tethers and carabiners, pushed myself off, dangled, and said, my God, this is incredible. You know, a ride at Disneyland. There's nothing like this. When I got back inside, closed the hatch, got out of the suit, it was a good feeling of accomplishment, which I will tell you is what kept you going on Space Station Mir, that sense of accomplishment that you're getting something done that's worthwhile. You're out there colonizing space. That's what gets you through the hard times.
Well, you couldn't exactly celebrate afterwards with a hearty meal.
No, but I did suck down some dehydrated, you know, mashed potatoes. And my favorite out of a tube is the Russian, you know, jellied piked perch. If you want to try a real delicacy, Tara, that's what you want. Jellied piked perch. I mean, sucked out of a tube. You know, I won't go near that stuff again in my life. But up there, anything was fine, and, you know, it's okay. But you get done with that spacewalk. I went back to my module. I actually wrote a letter to my son, John. He was 1 year old, and along the way I decided that, you know, it's important to let your sons and daughters know what you're doing in life and that you love them and what you stand for, what you hope and dream for them. And I wrote him a note that night, and I said, John, your dad has courage. Letting go of that pole when I was going 18,000 miles an hour and feeling the speed, that took courage. Got to my wall, strapped myself on, closed my eyes, slept like a baby.
Wow. Would you describe a little bit what it was like to stare at Earth from 300 miles away from it? What could you see? What kind of detail could you see?
Earth's spectacular. You've got the whole curvature. I'll describe, for example, I'm over Florida. I'm looking down, seeing the peninsula of Florida. I look up, hook of Cape Cod. St. Lawrence Seaway, the ice is moving out. It's January. It's moving into the Atlantic Ocean, hitting the Gulf Stream, these incredible 1,000-mile whirls defined by these 3-mile ice chunks, thousands of them out in the Gulf Stream, eddy currents peeling off. I look to the west. I see the whole Mississippi Delta, the whole Mississippi Basin, curvature of the Earth up ahead, you know, incredible.
Did you have a changing sense of what home meant? I mean, I think of home as being like my house, my neighborhood, my city, my state. But did it become like the planet where there's oxygen?
The planet is home, and you get a whole different perspective. I've said that experience in space changed my life. In the third phase of my life, I see things a lot differently. And the major change that took place in me is a change of perspective. You look down at the Earth, I'm flying over Italy, it looks like a boot, Sicily, Sardinia, you know, volcanic smoke coming out of Mount Etna, the Balkan Mountains. Got a one-liner that day that said people are slaughtering each other down there in the Balkans. You look down at it, you say, man, I'd love to grab the world leaders, pull them up here, let them take a look at our planet, one big whole planet, and those type of conflicts would stop.
My guest is retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is astronaut Jerry Lininger, And in his new book, Off the Planet, he describes his experiences when he spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. You returned to Earth from the space station Mir on the space shuttle with American astronauts. Would you describe what you experienced physically after 5 months in space, re-entering the Earth's atmosphere on the space shuttle?
Re-entry itself is just phenomenal, and, you know, it boggles the mind what we can do when human beings collectively set their minds to something. Mission Control Houston is controlling at that point, of course. We're in shuttle. We're over Australia. We flipped the shuttle upside down, inverted engines pointed in the direction we're flying, the direction of the velocity vector. They give you the go for deorbit burns. You fire the engines. You feel the shudder. You flip yourself back over. You start plunging through the atmosphere. Big fireball all around you, bouncing up and down, just a wild ride all the way in. If you don't like turbulence in an airplane, you would not like re-entry in the shuttle. It is the ultimate turbulence. You're just plunging through that atmosphere. Myself, people are very concerned. Astronaut before me said he felt like he weighed 2,000 pounds on landing, couldn't lift his arms off the mid-deck floor. Russians routinely, they reach into the capsule, pull them out after 4 or 5 months in space, plop them on a bed, roll them into the medical tent. So during that re-entry, I'm getting calls from the ground, how you doing in the mid-deck, Jerry? I'm moving my hand up and down. I'm actually feeling pretty good, dropping my ink pen a lot because I'm used to it floating as I set it out there. But lifting my arms, and they're feeling very, very heavy, but nonetheless pure joy, exhilaration. I'm heading home. Charlie in the flight deck yells out, Jerry, tally ho, West Coast. And I'll tell you, it just feels good to be over the U.S. again. Serious calls come in, how you doing? I say, hey, I'm doing great. It feels good to be home. 5 months.
Were you able to stand up and walk out of the capsule?
Well, the shuttle does its final turn, which is a manual one. We do the landing, rollout, deceleration. They open that hatch. I'll tell you, that air comes in. After 5 months of breathing air made out of urine, maybe that's why it was so wonderful. You know, the fresh earth air hits you, and my God, it's just, it just tastes good. Flight surgeon comes on board, says, Jerry, we got two guys out here, stretcher. You can sit here for an hour, 2 hours, whatever you need. We'll come get you when you're ready. And I said, Tom, you know, I've been in space for 5 months, overcome a lot of difficulties, started something, I'm going to finish it. I'm an officer in the United States Navy, and we don't get carried off on stretchers. And I'm going to walk off this thing, or I'm going to crawl off this thing. But please don't touch me. Stood up. Tell you, my chest started heaving like I've never felt it. My vision started going gray, closing in. Felt like I'm pulling too many G's in an F-14 or something. About to black out, and right at that moment, my chest kicks into a gear I didn't know I have. Remember what gravity's all about. Pump the blood back up to my brain, open my vision back up. Shuffled forward, and I'm sure I wasn't walking pretty, but I was on my own 2 feet. 90-degree turn, climbed over Mount Everest, which was actually my seat, about foot high. Felt like Mount Everest. Felt like you were sitting on my shoulders. Crawled out the side hatch. Two big guys there with a stretcher, surprised to see me. Said, welcome back, Captain Leninger. I shook their hands, told them, man, it's great to be back. Walked away. They did a couple claps for me. Said, you make us proud, Captain Leninger. And it felt good to be on my own 2 feet. And walking again.
What's happening with the Russian space station Mir? Is it still up there?
The Russian space station Mir is still up there. It is unmanned, and there's now talk of trying to send a manned mission up there to try to revive it, and talk of space tourism, trying to sign someone up. I think the price tag for the first person was $40 million, and everyone thereafter for $25 million to go up and go live on Mir for a few days and then come back.
What are you doing professionally now that you're a retired astronaut?
Well, I decided when I retired, actually Jim Lovell was commenting on the Mir, and he thought Mir should be retired with dignity. And I took those words to heart kind of on a personal level also. I told myself, you know, I did the spacewalks, been away from my family for 5 months. I've got my 3 little boys at home. I enjoy raising them. being with them, being with family. I'm not bored at all. Everyone asks, are you bored back on Earth after such an adventure? I'm not bored at all. You know, I count my blessings every day. The air's here, carefree existence, family around you, beauty of the Earth. You know, I'm very content living a pretty simple life. So that's what I chose to do. I wrote a book. I wanted to have a book for my three sons so that they knew what their dad was doing up there. And I'm doing some speaking around the country. But essentially, I decided I needed a couple years to sort of recover and get physically healthy again and get mentally healthy again.
One more thing. I'm sure one of the things you really look forward to about returning to Earth was having a nice shower. Describe how the shower felt the first time you took one when you returned
to Earth.
What
a letdown. You know, I was up there, you know, 5 months, no bath, no shower, no haircut, shave once a week if I'm lucky, if I could find the time. You come back, man, I was just dreaming about a nice shower. But I come back, I'll tell you, the transition from spaceman to Earthling was a tougher one than the other way around, from Earthling to spaceman. When I got in that shower, it felt like I was being bombarded by pellets, the force of the water hitting me. Felt like I was going to drown. My instinct as a spaceman was telling me this water's going to float. It's going to drown me. So it was very uncomfortable. My first glorious shower that I had dreamed about ended up being spent sitting on the floor with the water dribbling out and kind of giving myself a sponge bath.
Jerry Lininger, thank you so much for sharing some of your experiences and perceptions with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
Jerry Lininger is the author of the new book, Off the Planet, about his 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. I'm Terry Gross.
Space is the place. Space is the place. Space is the place. Yeah, space is the place. Outer space is a blessed place. A place that's really free. There's no limit to the things that you can do. There's no limit to the things that you can be. Your thought is free, and your life is worthwhile.
Space is the place.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Sisiv, building custom e-business systems for Global 2000 companies worldwide, on the web at CYSIVE.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1921, the black section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was all but destroyed in a race riot. The Oklahoma legislature recently created a commission to report on the riot's history and recommend whether reparations should be given to survivors. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to the lawyer who wrote the report and to a survivor of the riot. Join us for the next Fresh Air.